I'm here in the studio with Raymond Caballero, who's written this book I mentioned earlier, McCarthyism versus Clinton Jenks. Some of that is about Salt of the Earth. We don't want to focus too much on the film, but any thoughts, any way we want to complement what Laurie and Jan had to say?
I sure do. Norm, first of all, thank you very much at KBOO for having me on. Yes, there's a huge connection between the film Salt of the Earth and the life of Clinton Jenks, who was the initiator, along with his wife, of how the film happened in the first place. They went to a resort near Taos, New Mexico, and got connected with Hollywood figures, brought the strike to their attention, and that's how they happened to get involved in the first place. There was a group of blacklisted writers and producers and directors, and the film became so controversial, Jenks being the so-called Anglo insider of Mexicans in Grant County, that it led to his indictment. Within a month or so after the filming ended, Jenks was indicted.
The film played a role.
Yes, it did. It played two roles. One, it added to the hatred the Anglo community had for Jenks in the first place, locally. But the film brought him to national attention, and national figures then saw it as our previous speakers were talking about, a propaganda film. And they thought that really they were trying to show that Mexicans were being mistreated. This was going to be used by the Soviets against the United States. And there were discussions about it in Congress, and statements made about it in Congress. And that all made Clinton Jenks even more controversial.
One of the things I look for in artistic representations, artistic efforts along political lines, is how they deal with transformation, people coming to a new kind of awareness, a new sense of their own capability. And this film seems to me to be outstanding, Salt of the Earth, in its plausible transformation, in the way that it shows people able to be more than they were before. I love the film for that reason. Another aspect, and this is something that Laurie and Jan addressed, is what we now call the latest terminology, fashionable terminology, is intersectionality. The film is about the empowering of women, of overcoming racial discrimination, and of course, at its heart, it's a class-based film as well. Class struggle linked. Nobody in this film is saying, as was common at that time, first let's resolve class issues and then we'll deal with racial issues. Then we'll deal with the role of women. This film, they're integrated, and the film shows as well how class, race, gender are all part of the same and need to be dealt with all at the same time.
The writer, Michael Wilson, who wrote the screenplay for this film, called it the unity or the intersection of various types of equality. It was the general community versus the Mexicans there. It was labor versus the company. It was the women and the men. It was even within the own mining community how the Anglo miners were treated versus the Mexican miners. And he was trying to deal with all of these, what you would call intersections of inequality.
I wouldn't necessarily, but that's the language of today, right? It is something you just said was news to me, and that is that Jenks was targeted partly as a result of the movie. I was going to come to this later on, but in your book, one of the emphases is that he was targeted in part because he was an Anglo who took the Mexican side. He felt deeply and acted to overcome the kind of discrimination, the kind of racism that Mexican miners faced.
Jenks came to that position naturally. Even as a boy, he had this heightened sense of protecting the downtrodden, fighting for civil rights. In college, for example, in Boulder, Colorado, they basically had Jim Crow. The black students could not go to the local diners and so forth. And as a student, Clinton Jenks was deeply involved in opening up those diners and eating facilities for the black students there. So this is something that Jenks had been fighting. Actually, the communists, which Jenks was in the early days, they were at the forefront of fighting for civil rights. You know, that was one of the things that made him so controversial with Southern Democrats who were chairs of very important committees and who were at the forefront of the anti-communist movement.
Let's turn to McCarthyism then and the repression directly, not only through the film and as a result of the film, but this was, of course, well, this was a national phenomenon. Your book, do you think it directly addresses why we ended up with that climate of fear and of targeting of others? How would you account for, because obviously the question comes out of thinking about our own circumstances now. So what's going back to the history first, and then I want to come back to the present. How do we explain McCarthyism?
Well, first of all, there's a long strain in our history of fighting radicals, labor unions, and so forth, going back to the Hay Market incident in 1886 or 84, whatever it was.
86.
And the machinery of government and the enforcement agencies, private detective agencies, companies, and so forth, there had already been a union to fight working people and radicals going way back. So this is just a continuation of a long string. The Hoover, who I contend is the figure, rather than McCarthyism, should have been Hooverism. He was participated at the tail end of the first Red Scare in the teens, and that's how he got his start. And then, of course, was the driving force for anti-communism all along.
This is J. Edgar Hoover we're talking about.
Yes, J. Edgar Hoover, you're right. Thank you for the correction. The reason for this is there was a union of things that happened. There was already this strain I talked about, and then after the World War II, where the Soviets, one would say, became very aggressive, and we started with the bomb threats and so forth, and they were taking over Eastern Europe, and all of these movements made the Soviets extremely controversial. And what happened was there was a union, that is, the communists had made two mistakes. One is that the Communist Party was structured by Lenin, and it was conspiratorial. It was totally unforeseen that this so happened that the Russians became the first ones to do it. And the second part was that the American Communist Parties, as other Communist Parties, were perceived to be tools of the Soviet Union. So after World War II, when the Cold War started, immediately the anti-communists saw that they could disparage U.S. communists because they parroted often the Soviet lines. The American communists, unfortunately, gave the weapons of their own destruction to their enemies, and that was that they parroted basically oftentimes the Soviet line, and they were perceived to be tools of the Soviet Union. So right away, even though they had no connection, 99% of them, with any Soviet policy, they were disparaged for that reason. They were demonized, they were dehumanized, and that's how McCarthyism started. You could do anything. The governor of the state of Texas proposed the death penalty for communists. It never came to pass, but can you imagine proposing that somebody be put to death for joining a party that was legal to join, a perfectly legal act, and you had committed no crime, and you could be put to death? I mean, this is how outrageous McCarthyism became.
If we have time, I want to come back to that history, because there's a deep history within labor that precedes McCarthyism, and that I would offer as part of the explanation also. But let's stick with this theme. How is it you go about creating that kind of mass hysteria that would lead to the governor of Texas making that legally absurd proposal?
That gives you an idea of the climate of those times. How do you do it? Listen, in 1692, in Salem, Massachusetts, we executed 12 women, 5 men, 2 dogs for the crime of witchcraft. So you can get people ramped up about almost anything. And as I said before, the Palmer Raids in 1919 or so, where they rounded up thousands of people who had committed no crime whatsoever. They had to let a bunch of them loose anyway. But we have, in our history, oftentimes, for example, the worst one probably is that we picked up around 112,000 Japanese 2 months after Pearl Harbor. We arrested them, we incarcerated them, and we dispossessed them. We took children at their mother's breasts and oldsters who could barely walk and see, and put him in prison, who had done nothing. That's how what you can do when you use fear.
I guess the real question I want to ask you in that case is how to overcome that.
My book deals with the statement made by FDR in his first inaugural address about the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. We see it today. The use of fear to demonize and dehumanize Muslims, to dehumanize and demonize Mexicans, this is done constantly. The only way we can do it, I think, is for the American people not to fall into the trap of being fearful. And I wish I could tell you I could stop it, but I don't know. It's easy to use fear as a tool to obtain power. And it's a known tool. It's being used today, and it's been used in the past, and I wish I could tell you I had the antidote.
You're listening to Raymond Caballero, author of McCarthyism versus Clinton Jenks. I'm Norm Diamond. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. We're on KBOO FM in Portland, Oregon. Ray, what you just said raises a question that I find a kind of puzzle often, a paradox. And that's the question of the importance of constitutionality or of civil rights. On the one hand, we can emphasize them, and that's part of a legal defense, is saying that something, some action by a prosecution is unconstitutional. On the other hand, there's a pretense that those constitutional rights, that those civil rights under the Constitution somehow have been in operation, when we know, and you've just addressed this, that often they're in abeyance or they're used against and used in a discriminatory fashion. Do we emphasize civil rights? Do we emphasize the Constitution? Or do we also emphasize the kind of spotted history of those rights?
You know, that's a complicated question. I don't have the precise answer, but I'll tell you this, what you can see. I just mentioned the Japanese case where we locked up the Japanese in World War II. The Supreme Court, on at least two occasions, said that was legal. It wasn't until last year, while it was upholding another, what I would consider this Muslim ban of people being able to come in and being kept out by the Trump administration because they were Muslims. The Supreme Court upheld that. At the same time they did so, they just happened kind of in a footnote to condemn for the first time in 75 years decisions of the Supreme Court in the Japanese internment cases. Should we follow the Constitution? Yes. Unfortunately, what we have is the ideal versus the reality. The Supreme Court is obviously a political institution. It shouldn't be deciding cases on fear, but it rolls along with the punches. And so the Warren Court, Earl Warren's court, is brought out in this book, and it tells you what a change there was. Had Warren and Brennan and those folks not come in, the Jenks case, the importance of the Jenks case, would not exist. I think the old Fred Vinson court would have decided that case very differently. The current Supreme Court might decide that case very differently. I think perhaps the current Supreme Court might go back to Plessy versus Ferguson and stay with that decision. I'm serious. I think that if they had Plessy versus Ferguson in front of them, several of them would vote the way they did way back in the 19th century.
We need a parenthesis explaining Plessy.
Yes, that was a separate but equal case where they decided that it's okay to be separate and equal. In other words, it basically gave the imprimatur to Jim Crow and Jim Crow laws for many years.
Segregation legal under the Constitution.
Yes.
Jenks is the target. We want to focus a little bit on him also. The context is the Mine Mill and Smelter Union. It's an extraordinary union, especially the local that Jenks is an organizer for, because as we said in talking about Salt of the Earth, the struggle is not only labor, the struggle is against racism, against discrimination directed by the company, but also by the entire community against Mexican workers. That union has a little bit of a checkered past. The Western Federation of Miners that Mine Mill Smelter came out of had its own difficulties recognizing Mexican workers as potential union members and standing up for them. Mine Mill Smelter as a whole didn't necessarily take on that issue. This local pushed them hard. And Jenks, of course, was a big part of that. But these were people standing up for themselves as Mexican workers and as Mexican workers.
That's a good point. People don't understand that way back when, unions perhaps were among the worst institutions discriminating against blacks, Mexicans, and others. The craft unions especially, that is the plumbers, the carpenters, and all these skilled workers, they almost across the board did not let blacks or Mexicans join. It was the industrial unions who started really to have non-discrimination clauses. Mine mill had a non-discrimination clause back in, at least in the 40s, I know that. And by signing a contract with mine mill, companies were obligated not to discriminate against their workers on the basis of race or ethnicity.
But as you point out, of course, discrimination continued in that community from the company. Housing was provided by the company, but the housing for Anglo workers was quite different, the housing provided to Mexican workers. That's one of the themes, of course, in the film as well.
Yes, the laws against discrimination didn't undo everything. Vestiges, artifacts of discrimination continued. For example, if you had been denied a promotional opportunities in the past, many of these laws still, when you start out, you're still way down. And they did not undo all of those things. Housing, able to have running water inside and sanitary facilities and so forth. The Mexican laborers were treated very differently from the Anglo workers.
We have just 1 minute left. I think it'd be important to tell us what the Jenks decision was.
Okay, the Jenks decision in 1957 basically said it was the most important decision as far as defendants' right to obtain discovery. Before the Jenks decision, FBI files were secret. Someone could testify against you, and you would not be able to know what statements they had made to the enforcement agencies before. The Jenks decisions mandated that any relevant statement made by a witness had to be given to the defendant, period, without running it through the judge or anything. They just were entitled to that. That was an earth-shaking decision, and it was considered the worst defeat ever suffered by the FBI.
Good. That's all I can say about that is good. It's a good defeat for them to suffer. Been talking with Raymond Caballero. His book, McCarthyism versus Clinton Jenks. You can come meet Ray, actually, Thursday at Powell's on Hawthorne. Hear more about the book. He'll be talking about it with Barbara Dudley. Raymond Caballero, thanks very much for being here this
Norm,
morning.
Norm, thank you very much, and thanks to KABU.
There's problems with our forests, our garbage and the air. Corporations say they're green now, politicians that they care. But only you and I can set them straight. We can do it all. For united we stand, and divided we fall. For united we stand, divided we fall. You've got rising unemployment, folks losing you, I see. Families at the food banks, there ain't enough to eat. We need income redistribution, well, we can do it all. For united we stand, and divided we fall. For united we stand, divided we fall. Unions are getting shafted, lots of them back down. Time to forge some solidarity, bring the bosses down. No more separate unions, all for one and one for all. For united we stand, and divided we fall.